Thank you very much for inviting me. I am very happy to be here, and I very much look forward to any questions and comments, because what I am about to present is a very much a work in progress. I will be talking about one of the chapters in my new book. I actually have an outline. It's a tentative outline. It changes more or less every 2 weeks. So if you have any comments, I'm interested. As you can see, my book examines the interaction between young people in Poland and transnational developments during the so-called Global 60s, ranging from popular culture and counterculture to protest movements and anti-colonial revolutions. And of course, 1968 is very important to my book, but as you can see from the outline, I talk about many different manifestations of youth culture, popular culture and consumption. And I also try to talk about young people from different environments. So I devote much attention to urban youth, to students in particular, but I also talk about young people in the countryside, village youth, or young people who migrated from the villages to cities in the 1960s. I use a variety of sources. Many of them are institutional documents, party state documents, but also youth magazines, personal accounts, and oral interviews. And in fact, my goal is to get away from the conventional sources that are usually used when historians study communist societies, that is, institutional sources. I try to look at products of popular culture, such as popular magazines, but also popular books about youth or sex education manuals. So things that people were reading during that time. And surprisingly, the popular culture, the popular press in particular, featured a remarkable degree of pluralism. My methodological goal, or one of the methodological goals, is to look beyond the strict framework of national history. And to this effect, I try to challenge isolationist narratives of life in the Eastern Bloc. And I argue that the rapidly globalizing world of the 60s necessitated confrontation with outside developments. While the very idea of transnationalism and interconnectedness shaped youth behavior and state responses. So part of going beyond this, the strict limitations of the national context is to use a global framework. And by global, I mean the interaction between global and local forces. So the book is about Poland, but it talks about Poland in terms of how outside and local forces produced specific developments, how local actions are conceptualized in a global sphere. And there is a significant body of literature on that, but it is usually focused on Western Europe, the United States, and recently on the so-called Third World, especially Latin America. And all that literature is an inspiration for my work, but Eastern Europe has not really been so far incorporated into the studies of the global 60s. And in fact, my interest in the topic originated almost 10 years ago in 2007 when I went to a huge conference in Canada, in Kingston, Canada. The conference was devoted to the Global 60s. It featured about 500 papers, and among those 500 papers, there were only two on Eastern Europe. One of them was mine, and the other one was on Czechoslovakia, as you can probably guess. And that was all. So my question was, at that time, where is the Eastern Europe during the Global 60s? And I started my research, and I found out that actually, Eastern Europe was an integral part of the developments that were taking place during that time. And of course, when we talk about the Global 60s, otherwise known as the Long 60s, we don't mean the strict decade of the 1960s. It is usually the period that extends over almost two decades, from the mid-1950s to the mid-1970s. And there are debates about these chronological boundaries, and we can talk about that later. So today I would like to focus on a small part of my book, chapter 6, 1968. It's a very complicated part. 1968 is complicated, not only in Poland, everywhere. Yeah. one of the challenges that I have is to how to conceptualize this particular year in the Polish context. And I have only one chapter to do it. I look at the events of 1968 in Poland in a different way from the conventional narrative, that has been put forward mainly by Polish historians. And this narrative usually focuses on political developments, conflicts within the party leadership that affected the protests, some even say provoked the student and youth protests. In other words, the traditional Polish narrative of 1968 is very nation-centered. According to this to those accounts, student demonstrations began to the sequence of periodic revolts of Polish society against the communist regime. And these periodic revolts started in 1956, the narrative goes, then we have 1968, 1970, and the culmination is 1980 and the Solidarity Movement. And in fact, the memory of many participants of 1968 has also been nationalized. Leftist activists from the time, they were called by the party Marxist revisionists. I call them the New Left. Even though they don't use this designation, I consider them part of the international New Left at that time. So many leftist activists from the time now tend to downplay their Marxist beliefs and frame their narrative as a fight for national independence from the Soviets. And it's interesting to see actually how this dominant national narrative affected historical and personal memories. And one of my goals in this chapter is to find out why that happened. So documents and personal accounts from the time reveal that the events of March 1968, no doubt conditioned by local context, also represented a transnational moment. Student cultural and political activity prior and during the March Rebellion encompassed many elements of 60s youth culture across the globe, including linking their actions to historical revolutionary movements, not only Polish movements, but European revolutionary movements, and also anti-colonial movements, contemporary protests in other places, and the developments in the so-called third world. Students also employed global youth strategies, such as rallies, sit-ins, satire, humor, and performance. As many of their counterparts elsewhere, they evoked concepts of solidarity and authenticity. This is not to suggest mutual influences or imitation, but rather points of convergence. And this particular phrase comes from a book about the student movement in Brazil by Victoria Langland, which I'm using also in relation to Polish students in 1968. So these points of convergence formed as a result of the interaction between domestic concerns and external influences. So in many ways, the global dimension of 1968 in Poland is a forgotten story. And recovering that story helps us understand the complex impact of 1968 on Polish society. In fact, scholars have recently argued that the late 1960s were very significant in consolidating an ethnic and exclusionary vision of the Polish nation, basically the definition of the Polish nation as this exclusionary national community was not consolidated until the late 1960s. And part of the story has to do with 1968 and with the crashing of the student movement. So first, what happened in 1968 in Poland? So the student demonstrations in March 1968 were inspired by a cultural event. In January 1968, the party state banned the Warsaw National Theatre from performing the play The Forefathers' Eve, written by the prominent 19th century romantic poet Adam Mickiewicz. The regime claimed that this drama, and as many of you probably know, the action takes place in the 1820s, and it's about Polish revolutionaries conspiring against the Russian Empire, contained, unsurprisingly, anti-Russian and therefore anti-Soviet, anti-socialist elements. The ban immediately triggered a wave of protests from students and intellectuals with calls for ending censorship. How can you ban a 19th century play? Calls for more democratic freedoms, especially the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of the cultural expression. On March 8, the riot police attacked a peaceful student demonstration at the University of Warsaw. And this particular demonstration, it was actually a rally of organized by students. It was partially about the play, but it was also about broader issues. It was about the freedom of speech in general and about intellectual autonomy, especially for universities. The students were especially angry since two students, two of their colleagues, were arrested for talking about the protests against the ban to a French journalist. And the French journalist, of course, transmitted the message to the Radio Free Europe, and the RFE broadcasted the information back to Poland, and there was a lot of in the eyes of the party state, basically, this was unacceptable. So the two students, Adam Michnik and Henryk Schleifer, were arrested and expelled from the university. So this is a picture from the rally on March 8. In fact, the attack came in two waves. The first wave was the so-called voluntary militia, which was composed of civilians, mostly workers or workers, activists from different factories and offices. They were armed with clubs and they were basically beating the students. And after that wave of attack, the state dispatched the riot police. So the units that were specifically trained to deal with public demonstrations. In response to that brutal attack, students all over Poland started mass demonstrations and strikes to express solidarity with Warsaw students. I mean, many of them didn't even know what the rally was about, but they were outraged that the state dealt with a peaceful demonstration in that way, that there was this violent reaction. Students were often joined by high school students and also young workers. It was a full-fledged youth rebellion. And this is actually something new when historians started researching this topic. Until about 10 years ago, most historians argued that this was mainly limited to the student milieu, that the March 1968 demonstrations were specifically about students. However, recent research shows that actually it was more of a generational revolt, and most people who were eventually arrested were not students. They actually were either young workers or high school students. So here is, this is the photograph during the attack. Students are basically trying to run away from the riot police. This is in front of the main campus of the University of Warsaw. This is a demonstration in Krakow by the monument of Adam Mickiewicz. So these are the Krakow students and some faculty as well. Everywhere the demonstrations were brutally suppressed. Hundreds of students were arrested, hundreds of students and young people. Eventually, 1,500 students were expelled from the universities, and the most of the protests were over by the end of March. They continued in some other forms, but the street demonstrations were over by the end of March. So the state reaction is to deploy violence. But there is also a powerful propaganda campaign that is accompanying the attacks, the physical attacks on young people. In response to student and youth demonstration, the party state launched a powerful anti-Semitic campaign. Party officials and the media denounced protesters as Zionists, imperialists, and Marxist revisionists who wanted to overthrow socialism and the Polish state. As a result of this campaign, about 15,000 Polish Jews emigrated. So the student protest cannot be separated from the dramatic impact of the anti-Semitic campaign on the remnants of the Jewish community in post-war Poland. And I have to say that officially, the campaign used the term Zionists, so they never used the word Jewish or Jews. It was an anti-Zionist campaign, basically. So this willful embracement of radical right-wing nationalism by ruling communists shocked Polish educated elites. March 1968 became a turning point for the leftist intelligentsia. Many abandoned their faith in reforming socialism and turned to explicitly anti-communist political opposition. So the nationwide demonstrations were motivated by student and youth solidarity. But the rally, the gathering on March 8 at the University of Warsaw was organized by specific groups of students who had been politically active before. So now I would like to take a few steps back in time and talk a little bit about the origins of the protests. And I want to emphasize that these politically active groups were very small. Most students were not politically active in the early 1960s, not engaged in any organized political activity against the communist regime. So this is the leader of the Polish state during that time. In fact, his term almost exactly overlaps with the 60s era, right? 1956 to 1970. Mm-hmm. My book goes until 1974, but he definitely presides over most of the long 60s in Poland, and he's the leader who comes to power as a result of de-Stalinization in 1956 and promises to implement the Polish road to socialism. So that there is a lot of hope associated with this new leader. At the beginning, however, the Gomułka regime later on backtracks on many of the reforms from the de-Stalinization era, and there are attempts, especially to limit intellectual freedoms. So now the political groups that are active at the University of Warsaw are two groups. One of them is the commandos, komandosi in Polish, and they started, most of them at least, started as the Club of Seekers After Contradictions. The club was formed by Adam Michnik in 1962, and he was a high school student. So, and it was a group of high school students at first, and they, a discussion club, and eventually they continued their activity when they were students. And I think this picture comes from the late 1960s. Some of us can probably recognize some of our colleagues on this photograph. The other group, which was even smaller than this one, was the Vietnamese group, the Vietnam group, or they called themselves the Vietnamese. Interesting, both the commandos and the Vietnamese used the global imagination, the imagined West and the imagined Third World, to articulate their points about socialist democracy at home. And this question of anti-colonial revolutions is especially interesting and complex, because in the Eastern Bloc, support for decolonization, support for anti-colonialism, anti-capitalism, was a central part of state propaganda. So in the West, solidarity with Vietnam, support for revolutionary Cuba, would be important markers of being against the establishment, right? Being against the capitalist establishment. It was part of the protest language. Not so in the Eastern Bloc. That space was occupied by the official propaganda, by the state. So one of my questions is, was there an alternative language that young people created to talk about anti-colonial revolutions and connect them to protest movements? In general, transnational experiences were an important part of identity formation among defiant students in Poland. But most of the personal contacts took place with Western Europeans, especially many students traveled to France in the 1960s. And many commandos went to Western Europe before they started their activity at home. And I mean, we have to remember that youth in general had a very strong tendency to consider themselves during that time to be part of the imagined global community of youth, whether they actually personally experienced going abroad and going beyond Poland or not. I just finished a lecture on youth magazines in the class that David is teaching, and I was basically telling the students how the West was, there was a lot of Western material featured in youth magazines. The material from, especially related to youth culture, so fashion, music, the Beatles, mini skirts, Rolling Stones, and so on. So it was very marked, the youth culture was very much part of the imagined world, even if young people did not have a chance to experience that world personally. So, and as part of my project, I conducted oral interviews, and I have a few testimonies. I talked with people about their travel experiences. And for example, at the age of 17, Irena Grudzińska, who is actually featured on this picture, toured Austria, France, and Italy with her father, who went there on a work assignment. And she had this to say about her travels. This was in the early 1960s. In Paris, I had my first taste of Coca-Cola. So it's interesting how you can experience American culture through Paris. And in fact, many young people in Poland did just that. When they went to Paris, all they remember Hollywood movies and Coca-Cola. Irena also bought her first pair of blue jeans at the Lafayette Gallery. Adam Michnik left Poland for 3 months shortly after graduating from high school in 1964. And he said this: I met a lot of people, read a lot of books, talked with Polish emigre, Italian communists, French Trotskyites. I returned with the firm intention of doing something. I missed the beginning of the semester. End of quotation. So Michnik and other students formed this group that was later called the Commandos. And what the Commandos did at the University of Warsaw, they would come to meetings with party officials who would visit the university to talk about some political subject with the students. So, for example, there would be a talk by someone from the Politburo about the 50 years of the Soviet Union pacifist external policy. And when the Commandos found out about that talk, they would gather together and make preparations to challenge that speaker and to ask all kinds of uncomfortable questions and to show how the Soviet Union maybe did not always preserve peace. So, this comes actually from Michnik. We would come and sit all around the room. And after the speech, they would start asking questions. And again, I quote Michnik here. Janek spoke about Hungary, Juzek about Finland, Stefan about Yugoslavia, and at the end, I quoted Fidel Castro, who said that the peaceful coexistence Moscow fought for consisted in keeping the bombs from falling on Moscow or Washington, but they could fall on Vietnam. How do you feel as members of the Communist Party knowing that bombs fall on Vietnam every day? You don't do anything and you don't want to do anything. And indeed, as Michnik pointed out in this, in his account, the speaker, who at that time was Valery Namiotkiewicz, he was a secretary to Władysław Gomułka, the speaker couldn't tell if I was pro or anti-Soviet. In his place, I wouldn't have known either. End of quotation. So anti-colonial movements were a useful tool to help Polish students articulate local concerns. They helped identify contradictions in Soviet policy. They served to confuse their own leaders and to challenge the Cold War logic. Now, the other group made the connection to anti-colonial revolutions even more explicit. They called themselves the Vietnamese. In general, again, the Vietnam War was a centerpiece of communist propaganda. It belonged to the language of the establishment. And I think it is significant that the issue of Vietnam could not be avoided in student politics in Poland. While most Polish historians underplay these connections to the global Cold War, I actually find it significant that they are present. Because they tell us that it was difficult to express protest without references to the global Cold War and the anti-colonial revolutions. So this is, to me, this shows a kind of global consciousness that is present on both sides of the Iron Curtain. So the leader of the Vietnam group, and it's interesting that the two students who got arrested after the ban on the forefathers' Eve are Adam Michnik and Henryk Schleifer, and Adam Michnik is the leader of the commandos, and Henryk Schleifer is the leader of the Vietnamese. He organized his group in 1965, and the group organized demonstrations in front of the American embassy in Warsaw. They wrote petitions to the Polish government asking to provide help to North Vietnam. And Schleifer had this to say about his activity in 2007. Our thinking was leftist, but our critique grew from the fact that we felt that the communist regimes in Eastern Europe were playing with Vietnam, that help was provided, but it was limited. The support was ambiguous, so it was rather a rebellion against this kind of hypocrisy. End of quotation. And it was interesting that Schleifer was constantly under the surveillance of the security apparatus, even though he was doing the right thing. I mean, he was demonstrating in front of the American embassy. He was supporting the communist cause, right? However, this unexpected solidarity with Third World Revolutions expressed by a student outside the official state structures generated anxiety in party state circles. So communists considered themselves internationalists, but any internationalism that came from below was, of course, suspect. They considered that kind of solidarity very, very dangerous. So on May 1st, 1966, the Vietnamese organized an illegal Solidarity with Vietnam Day, to which about 2,000 students and faculty from the University of Warsaw turned up. They marched through the streets carrying banners with slogans that combined domestic and international issues. And I put just a few examples of those slogans. So they were mostly about domestic issues, but at the same time, they called this the Solidarity with Vietnam Day, and they, as you can see in the last example, they put Vietnam together with Poland, 1939, and Spain, 1939. So there is this historical and global thinking on the part of the students, the crashing of the left in Spain, the Nazi invasion of Poland, put together next to the American involvement in Vietnam. Finally, in 1967, it was the symbolic power of Vietnam that brought the two groups together, the commandos and the Vietnamese. In October 1967, the commandos distributed copies of the so-called Vietnam leaflet that called for the International Week of Solidarity with Vietnam. And here is the text. It's not the, it's more, the The text was a little longer, but I selected the most important parts. I don't know if you have time to read it.
What do the numbers mean up in the left there?
Oh. Yes, that's an interesting question. These are the numbers of people who are demonstrating, because this was an international event,
right.
The solidarity with Vietnam, the week. So they are putting the numbers: Washington, 140,000 people demonstrating; Paris, 100,000; West Berlin, 40,000; and Warsaw, they don't know how many, right? But again, I mean, you have this attempt to position themselves on the map of international demonstrations. And as you can see from the text, it's an intriguing mixture of historical and contemporary events. The leaflet basically listed injustices done to small nations by great powers, placing the Munich Agreement, the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, and the death of Che Guevara next to each other, all understood as an outcome of the same chain of developments. And many people, and in fact, the commandos themselves, after many years, explained this leaflet as a statement on national independence. Basically, they said that they decided to put forward a statement on Polish national independence. But when you, which was not part of their agenda so far, they were mainly concerned about socialist democracy, universal values of human rights and social justice. And this is, one can say, the first time that they make references, or at least they say that they try to make references specifically to the Polish situation as a Soviet satellite. But, I mean, even if we consider this leaflet to be a statement on national independence, it is remarkable for its passion for transnational solidarity based on common suffering and a common sense of injustice. So I think the question still remains. So why do you have to use Vietnam to express your standpoint on national independence? So this is October 1967. Now, fast forward to March 1968, when we have nationwide protests by students and young people, and the students are employing tactics that are employed, that are part of the international protest culture during that time. So this is a sit-in at the Warsaw Polytechnic. And you can see, I mean, the students are occupying the building. And you can see some of the slogans. So rallies, marches, sit-ins became important communal experiences that strengthened student solidarity. Students made passionate speeches, they sang songs, often switching between the Polish national anthem and the Internationale. Many students who did not really feel strongly about political issues became determined to engage in political activity upon witnessing the state action or upon participating in rallies and the sit-ins. And in fact, during my when I conducted my oral interviews, many people said that they were very much affected by this violent action by the state. One of my interviewees remembered the three-day sit-in at the Wrocław Polytechnic in Western Poland as a very, very important event that he would never forget. And he said the following: "It was not as if a couple of students, some sort of outsiders, decided to have a sit-in. This was a universal experience because it was about all of us. We students have never been through anything like this before. Because those stories about 1956 were something strange, some sort of hoopla to us. We knew there was some Poznań. He refers to the workers' uprising in June 1956 in Poznań, or whatever. But this was not about us. But then, in 1968, there was a chance to experience something so powerful, so unique. So now, the state response. What does the state do with all these massive demonstrations? That will come later. The state, too, used the global imagination, but in a very different way, to undermine students. So on March 14, just a few days after the March 8 rally, Radio Warsaw informed its listeners that, and I quote, West German circles inimical to Poland, including a group of the representatives of the Zionist organizations in West Berlin, staged demonstrations in solidarity with Polish students. And in fact, this was one of the first Polish regime messages that linked the domestic student demonstrations to transnational protest. And indeed, on March 13, there was a demonstration in West Berlin of West German students. The leftist extra-parliamentary opposition marched to the seat of the Polish military mission to deliver a protest letter addressed to the Polish government. Carrying red banners and portraits of Lenin and Trotsky, the protesters found the building locked, so they deposited the letter on a lamp post outside the mission. The West Berlin leftist group expressed quite clearly, however, that they supported socialism. What they protested was the state violent action against the students. But the broadcast was significant, and of course references to the Zionists, for its use of historical and transnational imagination. The contemporary global 60s landscape was now conflated with two traditional, quote-unquote, enemies of Poland, Germans and Jews. By doing so, the party state depicted the March Rebellion as part of the global student movement, while the global student movement was linked to distinctly anti-Polish activity at home and abroad. Soon, the state launched vehement attacks on Polish Jews. According to the press and party state officials, Zionists were responsible for student protests. And of course, anti-Semitism was used as a legitimizing tool for the ruling party, as an attempt to connect to popular anti-Semitic prejudices. So a lot of the state rhetoric built on interwar prejudices or even on the stereotypes of Judeo-communism by linking Zionists to Stalinists. So they are using these nationalist tropes that have a longer tradition in Polish culture, and scholars have talked about that. However, at the same time, what I would like to stress is the contemporary international politics. The anti-Semitic campaign was firmly entrenched in the Cold War context and was specifically designed to fight any manifestations of transnational solidarity from below. Party leaders and journalists, in fact, started linking Polish student demonstrations to all sorts of foreign influences, especially to radical movements in the West, but also to new lifestyles. So to all kinds of changes in sexual norms or to consumer culture, all the things that we associate with youth culture during that time. For example, until March 1968, student protests in the West occupied a marginal space in the Polish press and in general received a positive coverage. They were anti-capitalist, so that there was hope that that they were working against capitalist governments. After March 1968, accounts of student rebellions in Western Europe and the United States were depicted in strongly negative terms. According to the press, American imperialism and Zionism were responsible for student demonstrations everywhere, including the French May and so on. And in fact, one of the most popular words during that time used by the state was cosmopolitanism. Students were cosmopolitans because they congregated in coffee houses and clubs, and they were reading existentialist philosophers, and they were influenced by foreign ideas. It's also interesting that commentators often employed vocabulary from the fields of psychology and medical sciences to condemn cosmopolitanism as particularly dangerous. So they called, for example, cosmopolitanism was the first degree of, this is a quote, deviant internationalism that constituted the foundation for all other pathology of individual, collective, and societal life. And of course, those who supported and who participated in student demonstrations were affected by that pathology. I thought I had an article, one of the article from May 1968 that condemned student demonstrations, but I don't know where it went.
Censorship.
Probably, yes. So there is this attack on cosmopolitanism and on youth culture more broadly. The official press repeatedly linked youth lifestyles to the March revolt by denouncing student protesters as banana youth preoccupied with Western lifestyles. So how you acted, with whom you socialized, what kind of music you were listening to, it was all politicized. And in fact, commentators believe that the Polish state after 1956 had not been vigilant enough with respect to cosmopolitan influences on youth. Assuming that the very fact of growing up in a socialist society was sufficient to foster patriotic and ideological commitments. Meanwhile, culture became a critical weapon in a psychological warfare between East and West. And they argued that the youth demonstrations were a result of that. So the anti-Semitic campaign, or the anti-Semitic and anti-transnational campaign, they were relatively short-lived. The propaganda attacks lasted until the end of 1968 with different degree of intensity. Nevertheless, the anti-Semitic campaign left a deep mark on Polish society and on student activists. According to some scholars, March 1968 was critical to the demise of the Polish left. The anti-Semitic campaign strengthened the exclusionary vision of the Polish nation and elevated national discourses as the foremost legitimizing tools for any political activity. And Marxist students and intellectuals increasingly turned to the nation rather than to universal human values as the framework to formulate their anti-communist ideas. And they also started reinventing their personal stories of 1968. Before I end, I just wanted to give you some examples. By the early 1980s, many student leaders denounced their support for anti-colonial struggles that they supported in the 60s. This is a picture of Adam Michnik and Daniel Cohn-Bendit. They have been meeting regularly since the 1960s. They actually met in the 60s, but then they held these meetings as 60s protesters starting in the 1980s, I believe. And in one of those conversations in 1987, Michnik regretted his support for Vietnam. He talked about the Vietnam leaflet of 1967 as a mistake, and this is what he said. The first tract we distributed at the university was about Vietnam, and in it we put the American invasion of Vietnam and the Soviet intervention in Hungary at the same level. But the two are not comparable. Vietnam was a war against totalitarianism, and Hungary was a war against freedom, or at least that's my opinion. End of quotation. And Michnik accused the international New Left for standing up only for those who suffered from capitalist oppression, but not for the ones who were oppressed by communist regimes. Another student activist, Barbara Toruńczyk, reiterated similar sentiments in even stronger terms in 2002, as she accused Western students of, I quote, blindness and a foolish rebellion in the 1960s. Ironically, her language was reminiscent of the party state attacks on the global student movement in 1968, but adjusted to the Polish opposition's understanding of totalitarianism developed in the 1980s. In general, and to conclude, the events of 1968 polarized Polish society. The anti-Semitic campaign exposed the power of nationalism and anti-Semitism in garnering popular support. But the student and youth revolt of March 1968 affected different groups of youth in different ways. So my point is, it's not a totally dark story. The anti-regime Marxist left became weak, indeed, and this is really many scholars' point that this is the time when they start seeking connections to the church, to Catholic organizations, because they want to build their national legitimacy. While some students and intellectuals adopted the nationalist language to prove to the party state and society that they were Polish, others resisted nationalizing narratives. The year 1968 also marked the turning point for the flourishing of a variety of countercultural movements that flaunted transnational connections. The Polish hippie movement, for example, took off after 1968. Likewise, the experimental theater, the student theater, entered the golden era in the late 1960s. The intense countercultural scene that developed in Poland in the late 1960s and early 1970s could be read in part as an attempt on the part of some young people to resist attacks on global consciousness. And I am going to end my talk with this hippie art from Poland. This is actually an original drawing by a hippie from the late 1960s. Thank you very much.
Questions for our speaker?
Okay, yes.
Yeah, first comment. I think it's interesting because 1968 was also a critical year in Cuba, where it shifted from its romantic revolutionary phase to becoming much much more closely aligned Soviet satellite, and that was because the Soviets were putting pressure on Cuba to, you know, calm things down, less emphasis on exporting revolution and more on, you know, just building a socialist regime within Cuba. And I think supposedly they even threatened that they would cut off their aid and leave Cuba at the mercy of the US if they didn't calm down. So 68 was definitely a year of great change. My other question is, was there much interaction during the so-called Prague Spring between Polish and Czech youth? And how much of an influence did what was happening during the Prague Spring have on what was going on in Poland in the period?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Yeah, I have to investigate the first question for sure. It sounds intriguing. The Prague Spring actually was huge for the Polish student movement, and there were mutual influences because the students in Czechoslovakia were also influenced by the demonstrations in Poland. But in fact, and I talk about this in my chapter, during the protests, students would shout slogans such as "Long live Dubček," or they would march through the Czechoslovak consulate in Warsaw and basically cheer for Czechoslovakia and the Prague Spring. Or they had a whole series of slogans basically supporting Dubček and the Prague Spring and students. And you also saw that in the Vietnam leaflet, if you had time, actually, if you were quick enough to read it, they expressed support with the intellectuals, the Czechoslovak intellectuals, I think that's how they put it. It has a huge influence, and in fact, it's probably the most explicit transnational connection during the demonstrations of 1968. And another significant issue during that time is that Radio Praha is actually, people rely on the information
right.
on Radio Praha because they are giving a reliable information about the demonstrations. And a lot of the Polish state information was completely distorted, incomplete, of course, ridden with anti-Zionist propaganda. So they really appreciated the Czech media, Czechoslovak media, in getting some knowledge about what was happening. Mm-hmm. Catherine.
So thank you, Gosha, that was it's really interesting stuff. So I was struck by what you said at the beginning about this conference that you went to, where there's all these people and the two of you working on Eastern Europe. And you talked as well about this idea of points of convergence, about the way this is not just Paul imitating what's going on in the West, but it's something, it's a lot more complicated than that. And your talk today dealt mainly with the ways in which this was operating in Poland, and then sort of thinking about the ways in which Poles are conceptual, both the regime, the state, if you like, but also society, if you want to make that kind of artificial distinction, are thinking about what is global and how can we use these ideas in different ways to legitimize our own agendas. But I wondered, I mean, if you were speaking to a different audience today, if you were speaking to an audience of Americanists or people interested in French history, what can the Polish case tell those people about the global 1960s? In other words, to kind of flip it around a little bit, and to think about whether or not the Polish case can represent something larger to an audience who would be interested in the global 60s from different perspectives. Like, what is the Polish case telling those people, do you think?
I am trying to figure that out. I'm working on this, yes. Well, I think one contribution is that it brings in a non-capitalist context. We are used to think about the 60s, and that's what I learned about that conference in during that conference in Canada. We tend to associate protest movements with Marxism and anti-capitalism, whereas the Eastern European perspective shows a different dimension. And it really shows that it was that the protests were diverse, that they were about the establishment more broadly, that they were about the political elites on both sides of the Iron Curtain. So it really broadens our understanding of what the global 60s were about. And I have to think about other contributions as well. But that's the one that comes to my mind right now. Piotr?
Thank you so much for Sophie Dash. It was a really fascinating talk. So your narrative about the 1968 in Poland, the March protests in Warsaw, seems to be centered very much on the leftist discourse. They responded to the events in the Third World and to the regime. And I wonder how the story might be different if you look at individuals, students, perhaps workers, other intellectuals who are not leftists, who are explicitly or implicitly supporting directly capitalist ideas and perhaps national ideas, just anything that's not leftist. Thinking of individuals like Lobor Tirmand, I'm not sure if he was
He's gone. He's in the United States by that time.
But any other figures, I don't know if you encounter any other figures who are sort of not using the leftist discourse.
I have to say that 1968 demonstrations were very much about the leftist agenda. And in fact, it's hard to define what was leftist, what was left, what was right at that time. Students who took part in demonstrations and who expressed solidarity for Warsaw students came from all walks of life and all kinds of political beliefs. So, for example, prominent members of the current government in Poland, the nationalist right-wing governments, such as Antoni Macierewicz, were in the middle of the protests, because it was much more about student solidarity and protesting the state violent action than about professing any political or economic beliefs. So we have a lot of people participating in 1968 protests who later on become leaders of all kinds of rightist movements. And in fact, the post-communist elites, people who come to power after 1989, for many of them, this is the formative experience, 1968. But experienced, interpreted in different ways. Yes?
Yes, I find it very interesting this example, how 68 polarized Polish society, and now with the Communist Party turning to right-wing nationalism, which is, of course, hitting the great zone, and all that, but at the same time, you say the anti-regime Marxist left is also kind of, maybe not following them all the way, but also adopting a more national mentality.
Later,
and one
yes.
Kind of, So this kind of has repercussions for post 1989 Poland as well, because you're left without a real left, a left which is kind of self-critical, non-nationalist, and this is a problem for all of Eastern Europe. And it's kind of ironic that you have a communist regime, and as a result of that, you don't have a progressive kind of a real left in a way, not even in economic terms, but in terms of, I don't know, like ideas of nationalism.
Yes, I mean 1968 is the, many people would say the demise of the Polish left, but I mean I would probably not use such a strong term, but it's definitely, it's a turning point. And especially when you read the documents produced by the students before 1968 and after 1968, you see a huge difference, maybe not a huge difference, but you see a difference in discourse, how they articulate their points. Before 1968, it's much more about universal, you can say, leftist values. After 1968, it's much more about the nation. Yeah. Someone, yes.
Being a native Czechoslovakian,
uh-huh.
I guess from like my current perspective, I mean, they always thought that in the 60s, before Prague Spring, they would know all the music, Beatles, Elvis, Rolling Stones, and everything else. And so, like, when my parents would talk about it here in the States, I mean, many people wouldn't like, you know, couldn't like believe that, you know, how open it was. But after Prague Spring 68, everything got shut down. I mean, basically, like, overnight, everything was like, nope, no broadcast, nothing. So it was pretty crazy.
I find it interesting, this connection between culture and politics. And that's another issue that I deal with in my work.
But I was going to ask you, like, watching TV for youngsters in the 70s, you know, like, the show Kurtek, the black
I remember woman, that.
You know, the black one, everything else. I mean, it seems like, I mean, do you think the communist regime, in a way, you know, really used that much propaganda? And, you know, for, you know, little kid shows, that kind of stuff, you know, I'm talking like, let's say, from age 2 until, let's say, age 7 or 8. I mean, I don't know. Because, you know, for me, like, I don't think I really saw any of the propaganda.
In the 1970s, you mean?
Well, in like shows, you know, kid shows, you know, it wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. I well, Krtek didn't speak, right? That was the convenient part of the of the children's series. It's actually great, but yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call this a propaganda, but I think, especially for the case of Czechoslovakia after 1968, there was an attempt to depoliticize society. And to depoliticize society, you don't do this through political propaganda, you do this through turning the attention away from politics. This is actually, I guess I'm repeating Paulina Brent's argument from her book, how popular culture was used to make people focus on different things, not on political rebellions, but to popular culture and consumerism, right? But to basically to focus on making their lives comfortable, to focus on private life away from the political sphere. So I think it was a very important function that popular culture played in Czechoslovakia. In Poland, they tried this. They actually imported a lot of Czechoslovak shows from the 1970s. But it didn't quite work that way. And in fact, in the 1970s, in late 1970, when another leader comes to power, because Gomulka is deposed after the workers' protest in 1970, he is trying to court society with popular culture and consumption, and he is trying to sort of establish a state monopoly on youth culture as well. But he doesn't really accomplish his goal after. I mean, the consequences are often unpredictable of these consumer popular culture politics. All right.
Yeah, you said that about 50,000 Jews left Poland in 1968. But it's not just the number, it's the fact that the overwhelming majority of the Jewish community disappeared. How did the anti-Marxist left, as you call them, relate to the disappearance of the Jewish community in Poland at the time?
The anti-Marxist?
The anti-Marxist left. I'm just using your words.
Oh, no, no, I don't say they are anti-Marxist. They were Marxists.
Well,
the new left.
How did they react?
Oh, the Vietnam group. Oh, they were. The first reaction was astonishment. When you actually talk to people and when you read personal testimonies, a lot of the students came from Jewish background. Many of the commandos and both Michnik and Schleifer. But the first reaction was a complete astonishment that the Polish government. Communist government could do something like that. So this was, it was a shock in general. And the, and I think the aftershocks still persist. I mean, 1968 is a huge turning point in the memory of Polish Jews, not only those who left, but those who stayed. And also the shock of how the anti-Semitic campaign was effective in a way in terms of drawing popular support. And I mean, scholars would also talk about the Catholic Church, which tried to stay away from the campaign, but the Catholic Church also promoted a very similar version of the Polish nation, exclusionary. Ethnically based. So it's a traumatic experience, I would say, and the consequences are still felt. Okay, so we start. We go back.
Coming full circle, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions, they're interrelated. The first one is that even during the Cold War, Poland had a fairly relaxed policy as far as letting its citizens travel abroad. And I'm wondering what influence that would have had on the Polish dissident movement. And then related to that, do you know what the status was of the jamming of programs like Voice of America or Radio Liberty during this period? I know that it was relaxed a little bit for VOA, but not for Radio Free Europe and that.
Yeah. I don't know if I can answer the question about the jamming. I just know that, because, I mean, many people don't know this, but the RFE and the radio...
Liberty,
or Voice of America, actually, in Poland, they had programs, entertainment programs for youth. So, for example, jazz programs or playing rock music. Mm-hmm. And what I have been hearing from people during those time that the jazz or the rock music was being broadcasted, there was a certain wavelength that you had to know to turn your radio to, and it was not jammed because the security officers were listening to the jazz and the rock music. So, so you had to know all these complicated developments behind, right, the jamming business. And your second question was about?
It was about the fact that Poland was more
open. It was more open. I think it had a tremendous effect on generating a stronger dissident movement or a more extensive anti-regime movement than in other countries. I think it was very significant that Poles could travel and they could interact with people from other countries. Intellectuals, but not only intellectuals. I think it was a huge difference.
Maybe time for one more question, feel free to have.
Okay, yes.
Sure. Am I going? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just wonder why communist anti-Semitism was such an astonishment to leftists like me, Megan Schleifer. I mean, there was Stalinist, but not only Stalinist anti-Semitism going back to as early as the late 1940s, with Giedroyc having to defend Berman from accusations of the same discourse of sort of being Zionist and cosmopolitan and all that. So this is not something new that the Polish communist government suddenly adopted in 1968. There is a huge continuity going back to the 30s and not the 20s. So I wonder to what extent this discourse of anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism, to use their discourse, was effective because of some inherent anti-Semitism in Poland, or because it had been there for a while, for decades. I mean, where was the establishment coming from? Maybe it's easier to speak from hindsight, but I just...
It's a complicated question, but I think that, yes, I think they were aware that there was anti-Semitism within the Communist Party, but they didn't expect that it would be so much part of the public discourse and the public propaganda. I mean, it was all over the place. People were being dismissed from work, people were being expelled from schools, and the daily newspapers every day were talking about the Zionist threat all the time. So I think that part was astonishing, the public campaign, more than the fact that there was anti-Semitism within communist circles.
The Six-Day War is supposed to have played a role too.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the campaign really started in 1967, yeah. In June, yeah. After the Six-Day War. But then it stopped for a while, and Gomulka and other leaders used the student demonstrations to revamp the anti-Zionist campaign, yes. Mm-hmm. So there was this international dimension as well, right?
All right, well, let's thank our speakers.
Thank you.